Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. This is Andrew Peach, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 24th of September, these are our main stories. At the UN Climate Summit in New York, the teenage climate activist Greta Thunberg accused world leaders of failing young people. President Trump says he's not concerned about a phone conversation with his Ukrainian counterpart, which has prompted calls for his impeachment. And Zimbabwe's capital city Harare has been forced to shut its main water treatment facility due to a lack of foreign currency. Also in this podcast,
I am here with you as a mother, as a wife, as a woman of colour, and as your sister.
Britain's Duke and Duchess of Sussex start their African tour in Cape Town, where Meghan addresses the problem of gender-based violence in South Africa. And we'll hear how Spain is dealing with the legacy of former fascist dictator General Franco. The UN Climate Summit took place in New York on Monday, and the 16-year-old Swedish climate activist Greta Thunberg had an angry message for world leaders.
This is all wrong. I shouldn't be up here. I should be back in school on the other side of the ocean. Yet you all come to us young people for hope. How dare you? You have stolen my dreams and my childhood with your empty words, and yet I'm one of the lucky ones. People are suffering, people are dying, entire ecosystems are collapsing. We are in the beginning of a mass extinction, and all you can talk about is money and fairy tales of eternal economic growth. How dare you?
Quite a moment. Cristiano Figueres oversaw the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, which led to the Paris Accord of 2015. She told the BBC she agreed.
I think it is the responsibility of my generation, that is the generation that is sitting at the table right now, to certainly get in touch with our responsibility and our concern for the future generations, and at the same time, not be paralyzed by it. This is our responsibility. This is not a responsibility of future generations to fix this.
But some country leaders did pledge to do more to tackle climate change. New Zealand's Prime Minister Jacinta Ardern said there was still hope.
Over 80% of our electricity already comes from renewable hydro and wind, and we have begun an ambitious agenda. We have introduced to Parliament the Zero Carbon Bill, the purpose of which is to ensure New Zealand lives within the threshold of 1.5 degrees Celsius of global warming.
And the German Chancellor Angela Merkel said Germany would double its financial commitment to fight global warming.
The industrial nations are those that have caused global warming as we see it today. The developing countries are those that suffer most from this phenomena. And this is why we, as representatives of industrial countries, have the obligation to put our technology and the best of our knowledge and our finances into stopping global warming as we know it. Internationally, we shall increase our funding for global climate protection from 2 to 4 billion euros compared to 2014. In particular, we will earmark 1.5 billion and pay this into the Green Climate Fund.
On Sunday, a report was issued that showed carbon emissions are increasing faster than ever. The last 5 years looked likely to be the warmest on record. Sea levels are rising by 5 millimetres a year. For more on Monday's summit and the reaction to Greta Thunberg's speech, I've been speaking to our correspondent in New York, Neda Torfik.
Many people are used to seeing her so composed, even when she is so passionately speaking about this topic, which is so close to her heart. But you could actually see her quaking with rage as she spoke there. And everyone that was watching saw the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres looking on, smiling, happy, because as he said before, this young generation has made him feel more optimistic that they can force change. the countries and cities and businesses that were there, on the other hand, it was almost like a nervous laughter, knowing that they weren't really rising to the challenge. And what's interesting is that the Secretary General said from the get-go he didn't want this summit to be about fancy speeches. He wanted it to be about real commitments. But instead, what we saw today really was just, again, a number of fancy speeches. So, for example, China, the world's largest emitter of greenhouse gases. They said, we're meeting our commitments under the Paris Agreement, but they didn't go any further than that. You had, Germany, for example, they did go a bit further. They said that they would be investing $60 billion over the next 10 years to transition to clean power, and that they would also contribute to a UN fund to support less developed countries to combat climate change. So these were some of the asks of the Secretary General. So we did see the likes of, Germany, others like Norway, Denmark, the UK also committing to net zero greenhouse emissions by 2050. But largely, this really didn't come close to what I think activists really wanted to see.
President Trump was not expected to turn up at all. Actually, he did attend for a brief period of time. Was that warmly welcomed by people there?
Yeah, it was interesting because it wasn't expected. And he basically went for a brief appearance. He listened to the German Chancellor Angela Merkel speak, Narendra Modi, the Indian Prime Minister speak. But then the UN Special Envoy on Climate Change and the former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg actually addressed Trump when he popped up, said, hopefully our deliberations here will be helpful to you as you formulate climate policy. And everyone laughed because, of course, President Trump has rolled back a lot of the protections aimed at combating climate change in the United States.
Our correspondent Neda Torfik with me from New York. Now, as the scandal surrounding a phone call President Trump had with his Ukrainian counterpart in July snowballs, there's further pressure on the president to release the transcript. Mr. Trump has called it a Democrat witch hunt and dismissed calls for the launch of impeachment proceedings against him.
We had a perfect phone call with the president of Ukraine. Everybody knows it. It's just a Democrat witch hunt. Here we go again. They failed with Russia. They failed with recession. They failed with everything. And now they're bringing this up. The one who's got the problem is Biden. Because you look at what Biden did. Biden did what they would like to have me do, except for one problem. I didn't do it.
So what is the president insisting he hasn't done? Our correspondent in Washington is Gary O'Donoghue.
The allegation is a serious one. It's that the president may have tried to lean on the Ukrainian president to conduct an investigation into the man who may be his primary adversary in next year's general election, i.e. Joe Biden, and his son, Hunter Biden, who worked for a Ukrainian company for 5 years. And on the face of it, that would be a pretty serious thing, wouldn't it? I think you don't need to be a student of political science to know that's a pretty serious thing. So we'll see. The president has talked about possibly releasing the transcript of this now infamous call back on July the 25th. We don't know whether he's going to do that. He has the capacity to do that. He can declassify anything he likes in this country. That's part of being president. But he's obviously worried about the precedent that would set. And in the meantime, the Democrats are keeping up the pressure in Congress, saying that they want the details of this whistleblower's case released to their committees by Thursday. Otherwise, Nancy Pelosi is not using the word impeachment, but talking about a whole new stage of investigation into the president.
And I was going to ask you about impeachment, because some other people are starting to use that word. Is that a realistic prospect from what we know?
Loads of people have been using the word for a long, long time, don't forget. I mean, more than half of the Democratic caucus in the House, particularly the new intake, those on the left, the progressives, as they like to call themselves, they've been demanding this from the very outset. What you're seeing is some of the more, if you like, reticent heads in the leadership, people like Adam Schiff, who leads the Intelligence Committee, Nancy Pelosi, the House leader, so starting to sort of drift in that direction with this latest revelation. Adam Schiff saying, for example, that we may have crossed the Rubicon when it comes to the question of impeachment. Nancy Pelosi not using the word, but as I said, talking about a whole new stage of investigation, a grave new level of lawlessness, as she put it, potentially. So they are under pressure from their own caucus to go down that route. But of course, they have always been very cautious. They understand and they realise and they believe that impeachment is as much a political process as it is anything else, and that it can backfire in the way as it backfired against the Republicans with Bill Clinton back in the 90s. If you remember, when he was successfully impeached in the House, he was not convicted in the Senate, controlled by Democrats at the time. Republicans control the Senate right now. And he got a great big bounce in the opinion polls as a result.
Gary O'Donoghue with me from Washington. A new type of cancer drug capable of treating a wide range of tumours has been approved for use in the European Union. The health service in England has described it as revolutionary. This drug targets genetic abnormalities inside a cancer. More from our health and science correspondent, James Gallagher.
Larotrectinib is the first of what are known as tumour-agnostic drugs. And these type of medicines are regarded as the future of cancer treatment. Whether the cancer is in the bowel, the breast, or the lung does not matter. The key is the specific genetic abnormality that turned a healthy tissue malignant. Larotrectinib works only against NTRK gene fusions. It sounds complicated, but it means two pieces of DNA have accidentally merged and the alteration leads to cells growing out of control. But this abnormality can appear in a wide variety of tumours, from the brain to the thyroid to the kidneys. Doctors who have been trialling the drug at the Royal Marsden Hospital in London say the approach is really exciting. Its approval by the EU marks a move away from treating cancers based on where they are in the body and towards precision medicine that takes advantage of understanding the genetic makeup and weaknesses of each patient's tumour.
James Gallagher reporting. Russia is once again in the spotlight over doping allegations in sport. The World Anti-Doping Agency says there were inconsistencies in laboratory data provided by Russia earlier this year in order to have a ban lifted. And now WADA is launching an inquiry. The organisation's president, Craig Reedy, said they had to follow strict legal procedures before deciding whether Russia was complying with regulations or not.
We have found, quite honestly, some inconsistencies. And we don't know yet whether it's tampering or manipulation or whatever else it might be. Mm-hmm. And since the rules state that ultimately, if there is to be any, if we assert non-compliance in Russia, inevitably, and they don't accept it, mm-hmm. inevitably it will be settled by the Court of Arbitration for Sport. Mm-hmm. So you have to be very, very careful before you go into the law that you don't transgress any of the legal rules. You have to know exactly what happened, and that's the process we're involved in.
Russia is banned from competing in the World Championship starting in 4 days' time and could potentially miss next year's Olympics in Tokyo. Here's our sports news reporter, Alex Capstick.
We don't know the exact details of these so-called inconsistencies, but we have heard from the man who has been leading the investigation. He's been leading the compliance review committee, making sure that Russia remains compliant with the WADA code. And he said it would seem, and he's very disappointed by this, that positive findings have disappeared or have been covered up. So they're looking into that now. The reason they think they know this is because they were given a copy of the documentation from the Moscow lab by a whistleblower. They're now comparing this with the information that was handed over by the Russians officially back in January this year. The reason they wanted all of this information, this data from the lab, is because it's connected to athletes who were tested by the Russians during this doping conspiracy, one of the biggest in the history of world sport. They're looking for more cheats. These are athletes that took part in the 2014 Winter Olympics and other major events. They've looked at the authenticity of this data. They think there's something wrong. Things aren't quite matching up. They want to know why, and that's why the Russians have been given 3 weeks to explain what has happened here.
Alex Capstick reporting. Still to come in this podcast.
The world just doesn't fit women very well. It can be something like being too cold in an office because the temperature of the office has been designed according to a formula that uses the metabolic resting rate of the average male.
The book Invisible Women, Exposing Data Bias in a World Designed for Men has just won this year's Royal Society Science Book Prize. In Zimbabwe's capital, Harare, the city's main water treatment plant is being shut down due to a lack of foreign currency. Officials have described the situation as devastating. For more on this, I've been speaking to our Africa regional editor, Will Ross.
The deputy mayor of Harare, Enoch Mupamawande, has said that $2.7 million are needed every month just to buy the water chemicals that are needed to ensure that it's safe water that's coming out of the main dam. The level of that dam has dropped because of the drought, and the water treatment plant now has been closed because they simply don't have the money to buy these chemicals. So it is quite an extreme measure. It might be one where they're putting some pressure on the central government to cough up a lot of money to ensure that the plant can open quickly. And they're actually calling on President Emmerson Mnangagwa to declare this problem a national disaster. So they're putting some pressure on the central government.
Is there yet any evidence of this having an adverse effect on people who are living in Harare?
There are certainly increased reports of cases of diarrhoea in different parts of the capital. And I think that the biggest problem, I mean, at the moment they're saying it's diarrhoea, it's not cholera, but the biggest problem or fear is that there will be cases of cholera and or typhoid. And this comes, you know, a year after Zimbabwe had its worst outbreak of cholera in about a decade. 26 people died last year. So there are certainly fears that by closing down this water treatment plant, there is a high risk of waterborne diseases such as cholera and typhoid re-emerging in the capital.
Our Africa regional editor, Will Ross. The Supreme Court in Spain is expected to decide today whether or not to accept the government's plan to exhume the body of the former dictator General Franco. Franco led Spain's fascists in a brutal civil war in the 1930s, which claimed the lives of around 500,000 people. His supporters oppose any plan to remove his body, but many Spaniards say his official gravesite is a triumphalist monument to his rule. From the Valley of the Fallen, where General Franco's tomb is, our correspondent Alan Little looks at how Spain is dealing with its past.
It's here on a hilltop north of Madrid, facing into the rising sun, that Spain's battle between memory and forgetting finds its most eloquent symbolism. This monument is so vast that you can see it as you approach from over 20 miles away, but it's only when you stand at the base of it that you understand just how imposing it is. There's a crescent of arches in grey stone, at the centre of which is a door that leads into a basilica that's been carved out of the interior of the mountain. And in that basilica lies the body, the tomb of General Franco. And above that tomb, on the mountaintop itself, is what's said to be the tallest Christian cross in the world. It rises 150 metres into the sky. When it was inaugurated in 1959, it was intended as an expression of reconciliation between the two sides in the civil war. But at the very least, it lends itself to another interpretation altogether, for many Spaniards see in this a triumphalist celebration of the victory of fascism in that war.
Franco after the war. Okay. By that time he should be about 42 years.
So this is him right at the start of his... The retired armed forces officer, General Juan Chicharo, is the president of the Francisco Franco Foundation. He has fought the plan to remove Franco's remains. For him, this is a place not of fascist triumphalism, but of national healing.
You can see that the Republican soldiers are in one side, nationalists are in another side. There are angels in one side and angels with their arms here and their arms there. And those arms are pointing the cross, no? Reconciliation. Spanish was built as a Christian nation, Catholic, and the cross symbolizes our history.
Are you wearing a cross now?
Yes, here it is.
Eh? That's important to you?
Very important.
To Spain?
And to Spain, of course.
That's not how it feels to the families of the Republican dead.
This is José Antonio Marco Viedma, my great-uncle, my grandmother's brother.
And he was killed when?
On the 2nd of September 1936.
Silvia Navarro is campaigning to recover the bodies of nine men killed by Franco's troops, including her great-uncle. He was taken from his home in 1936 and shot shortly afterwards for his Republican sympathies. After the war, all nine were exhumed from mass graves and reburied at the Valley of the Fallen. Their families were never consulted.
I think Franco's body must be removed. The only idea that people who were killed by Franco or by Franco's troops or whatever are buried together with Franco, it's very absurd, very horrible, and they're still glorifying him as if he was the savior of Spain. And he was not the savior, at least not for more than half of Spain.
For that Spain, the Spain of those defeated by Franco, the Valley of the Fallen is not a place of reconciliation, but of an injustice ignored for too long, in a country still torn between the struggle to remember and to forget the past.
Our correspondent Alan Little in Spain. Harry and Meghan, the Duke and Duchess of Sussex, and their four-month-old son Archie are in South Africa to kick off their first official tour as a family. Meghan said she supports work to fight sexual violence in South Africa. This comes days after President Cyril Ramaphosa announced an emergency plan to tackle gender-based violence after the high-profile murders of young women. Our royal correspondent Nicholas Witchell is with the royals as they begin their tour in Cape Town.
They both know that this trip has to work well after recent missteps. So Harry and Meghan dispensed with a red carpet welcome and came straight to a township. The exuberance of the welcome masks the fact that Nyanga Township has the highest murder rate in South Africa. The couple had come to show their solidarity at a refuge for women and children. And amid all the hugs and the hand-holding was the serious message. Violence against women is a huge problem here. Meghan marked out her resolve to be heard.
While I'm here with my husband as a member of the royal family, I want you to know that for me, I am here with you as a mother, as a wife, as a woman of color, and as your sister.
And that, of course, was very much Meghan, articulate, passionate, and about a subject about which she cares very deeply. It confirms that there's a certain defiance on the Sussexes' part to do things their way. They have 10 days in southern Africa to show whether it works.
Our royal correspondent, Nicholas Witchell. A model for Gucci, who is made to wear a high-fashion take on a straitjacket, has staged a mental health protest during Milan Fashion Week. Aisha Tan Jones, who's non-binary, so doesn't use he or she, but the pronoun they, displayed the words, "Mental health is not fashion," on their hands. Ellie Costello has more.
There's been huge amounts of support for Aisha on social media, especially on their original Instagram post. Lots of people saying, "You're my hero. Thank you for doing this for us. You're so brave and so inspiring." But there's also been criticism from people who were actually at the show, namely from the model and actress Harry Neff. She's actually defended Gucci. She said that the straitjacket concept was a provocative reminder of submission rather than the glamorization of insanity. There's also been lots of comments on Aisha's Instagram saying that if they wanted to protest, then they should have flatly refused to have taken part in the show. And they shouldn't have taken a fee. We had a blackface scandal at the start of the year. This is where a jumper was being sold by Gucci. It was a black balaclava-style jumper. It was being sold for about $900, I think. And it came up over the face, and then it had red oversized lips on the outside. So you can imagine the backlash to that item. Lots of people were saying it was blackface. And Gucci came straight out and apologized for that, and they pulled it from their shops and from their website. It was actually after that incident where they hired their first diversity manager because they wanted to avoid offence like that to ever happen again. And ironically, Sunday night show was the first ready-to-wear show since that appointment.
Ellie Costello reporting. Now, when we think of gender bias, we may think how many fewer women there are in the top positions in government or business or the gender pay gap. Things like protective work clothing office temperature, the size of a smartphone, are also part of the gender inequality problem, according to the author Caroline Criado Perez. Her book, Invisible Women, Exposing Data Bias in a World Designed for Men, has just won this year's Royal Society Science Book Prize. She spoke to Tim Franks straight after the award ceremony.
Well, essentially, the vast majority of information that we have in the world, that we've collected in the past and that we continue to collect, has been on men. So male bodies, typical male lifestyle patterns. And that goes from economic data to medical data to workplace data to travel data to design data. And the result is that the world just doesn't fit women very well. And
can you give me some examples?
Well, so, I mean, it can be relatively minor, something like being too cold in an office because the temperature of the office has been designed according to a formula that uses the metabolic resting rate of the average male. And women's metabolic resting rate is lower. And so offices are often about 5 degrees on average too cold for women. But it can be much more serious than that. So, for example, for decades, the only car crash test dummy that was used and that was used to design car safety around was based on the average, on the 50th percentile male. And the result of that is that women sort of don't sit in the right position, seat belts aren't right for women, and ultimately women are 47% more likely to be seriously injured if they're in a car crash, and we're talking life-changing injuries here, or 17% more likely to die. Similarly, women are 50% more likely to be misdiagnosed if they have a heart attack, and they're also more likely to die if they have a heart attack. And that, again, is down to the research on all sorts of things, from, you know, risk prediction models to the treatments that we've been developing have been mainly developed in men. And so they just don't work as well for women.
Why? I mean, that seems, all of it is extraordinary, but that seems particularly remarkable that you would think that medical trials, which would be the most policed part of any research, you would think that they would think to have a split between women and men.
You would. And discovering that this was an issue in the medical world was, in fact, why I wrote the book, because I, like you, found it so shocking and sort of incomprehensible. Yes, you would think the medical world would be on top of this. But it's essentially the same reason that we don't, you know, that we sort of didn't notice that there weren't female car crash test dummies. It's that we're so used to thinking of men when we think of a human being, and we all do this, we all have this bias, that we sort of don't really notice that we're doing it. Or even when we do notice it, we sort of justify it to ourselves. So medical researchers will often say, well, women are too complicated to measure.
They don't say that.
They absolutely do say that. Women are too complicated and, you know, the menstrual cycle will interfere with the results. Well, yeah, the menstrual cycle will interfere with the results, and that's a reason to study the menstrual cycle, because it will interfere with the results in the real world.
Caroline Criado Perez with Tim Franks. And that's all from us for now. There will be an updated version of Global News to download later. If you'd like to comment on this edition and the stories we chose to include, do drop us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. My name's Andrew Peach. Thank you for listening. And until next time, goodbye.